All right, welcome to Water for Fighting, where we discuss the past, present, and future of water in Florida with the people who make it happen. I'm your host, Brett Cyphers. This week's discussion is brought to you by Sea and Shoreline and Resource Environmental Solutions. Sea and Shoreline is the Southeast's leading innovator in protecting coastal communities from devastating storms and restoring ecosystems that once faced ecological collapse. Visit their website at www.seaandshoreline.com. And of course, Res is the nation's leader in ecological restoration, helping to restore Florida's natural resources with water quality and stormwater solutions that offer communities guaranteed performance and outcomes. Check them out at www.res.us. All right, this episode is going to be a lot of fun for me because it makes two in a row that I get to sit with an executive director of a water management district. In fact, this will actually complete the series of all five current EDs.
Saving the best for last.
Right? That's right. That's right. Yeah. And so we're going from the fifth largest district, as Steve Minnis likes to say, to the biggest of them all, the South Florida Water Management District. And as you heard, that
the original water management district.
The original, yes. First you had South and then Southwest, and then a long time before the others, right?
Right. When we were the Central and South Florida Flood Control District before we were even a water management district.
Established
in the 40s.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think, Southwest wasn't until like 60 or 61, something like that, right?
Right, I think so.
Yeah. Well, you just heard the dulcet tones of Drew Bartlett, the current executive director of the South Florida Water Management District. When I met him, he was at DEP as the division director of environmental assessment and restoration. But before he was tapped to serve in his current role at the district, he served as a deputy secretary for ecosystem restoration at the department as well. So a lot to unpack there. Probably not a full history of the CNSF, but Drew, anyway, welcome to the show, sir.
Thanks, Brett. It's good to be here.
So winding is the road that led you to us here in Florida in our warm embrace. But let's start at the beginning. You're born in Macon, Georgia, but your parents definitely were not. So let's talk about them a little. And I want to talk about your mom first, because she's from a better state, or at least one I like better.
She's from Richmond, Virginia, right? And she is from a family that with a lot of lineage in the U.S. In fact, her name is Eleanor Washington Lee, because she's related to George Washington and Robert E. Lee.
Wow.
Right? So say that for the amount of pressure she had on her. Yeah, she came out of Richmond. My dad, Harwood Bartlett, came out of Brooklyn, New York. And they basically both landed in Atlanta, Georgia, right? She went to Agnes Scott College. He went to Georgia Tech. And then they met when he went into the ministry. So he is he's a priest, and he was serving at a church in Atlanta when they met, and she was doing some work with that church. Yeah.
So tell me about the college your mom went to. I don't think I've ever actually heard of it before.
Agnes Scott is a women's college in Decatur, right outside of Atlanta.
Okay.
It's a longstanding women's college.
And you said your dad was Episcopal minister, is that right?
Yeah, he was an Episcopal priest. Okay. You know, he retired and he's passed at this point. But he was a math major at Georgia Tech, then went into the Air Force, and then just found himself in the ministry. And she is a psychologist, and she still is a practicing psychologist, family and individual therapy. I was raised perfectly.
It seems like it would be weird for me. It's like if, a mom or dad were a psychologist, because you're constantly being, kind of poked at, it seems.
She made sure I was shaped perfectly.
Wonderful. So why your dad picked the ministry then?
It was a calling. It is a fascinating field. Going through that process, it was a way to help people and give back to the community. And he was always a servant, right? He always wanted to be a servant of the ministry and of people. And in fact, he was a priest for a while, and then when he retired as a priest, he basically went into work on homeless shelters and so forth for Episcopal charities, essentially. So that's really where he wrapped up his career, is really giving back to the community. Wow.
That's really cool. And your mom is still in Atlanta?
She is.
Okay.
Yep, she's still in Atlanta and still practicing. She's 82, I think, at this point, right? So she's a spitfire for sure.
So when did they get married and that connection? So they both ended up in Atlanta, but how long had they been in Atlanta before they intersected?
I mean, I'm not exactly sure, a few years probably. But after they got married, he got assigned to lead a church in Macon, Georgia.
Right.
Right. And so this was in the 60s. So he was in Macon, Georgia, a minister of a church, a priest of the church there, going through desegregation.
Wow.
Right? And so he tells stories of working with his congregation to help with that desegregation, which was, of course, very challenging. Mm. My mother was very active in the civil rights movement. And so she tells stories to me of going to basically the black waiting room at the hospital. And instead of going to the white one, protesting it, and would go into the black one and really just kind of as a protest, both very active in that whole movement.
And it seemed like, not just, Macon, but certainly Atlanta as well, obviously a very, famous kind of epicenter for civil rights.
Right.
Is that why they, ended up making their life in Atlanta all those years? Because they stayed, right? They moved from Macon back to Atlanta after you were born.
Yeah, when I was four, they moved to Atlanta, and he basically became the head priest of a larger church in Atlanta, St. Bartholomew's, and I grew up in the rectory there, and she did her practice out of the den in that rectory. Hmm. Do not walk in on those sessions, right, when you're a child.
right.
So, yeah, it was a good way to grow up, A lot of built-in friends.
A Growing Pains reference or something? Was Alan Thicke or something?
Right.
His practice out of his somewhere in his house. I guess it works.
It was cheap errand.
Right. So you were born in Macon, and they moved back to Atlanta. I think I saw you were at 4 years old.
I was four, so I have very little memory of Macon.
Yeah, I was going to ask, because do you have any memory whatsoever of it? Not really.
Not really.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I could picture the house and something like that, but not. No meaningful events.
Right. I try to superimpose ones from this. We lived in Lakeland until I was about the same exact age. And I think I see pictures and I assume that I had a memory of that little event, but I don't.
Right.
No. All right. Well, let's talk about Atlanta. And you say you grew up in Atlanta, but that typically means for most people, because I have family around and in there, is that means anywhere between McDonough to the south and Dawsonville to the north. Were you in Atlanta, or were you in one of those like Roswell, Marietta, Alpharetta kind of places?
We were inside the perimeter. And when you live in Atlanta, there's inside the perimeter and then there's OTP, outside the perimeter, and you need to get your shots and pack a lunch out there.
Well, it's a waking nightmare getting inside that perimeter. So,
yeah.
So what were you like as a young kid? Like, what were the kind of things that you enjoy doing? Did you like school, sports? Did you spend a lot of time outside? It's a great area for it.
So I'm an August baby. And not only am I an August baby, but I'm thin and light. And when I was going through school, I was small. So sports didn't fit too well with me. Watching TV fit pretty well. So school was a survival. And I had some rough and tumble schools in that area. So it was certainly an experience. And I was on the nerdy side of things. I like, Nintendo and, nerdy things.
Sure.
Right.
Sure.
So that's kind of, and so I hung out with that crowd, and that was, popular crowd.
So rather than, say, a party on Friday night, it was Dungeons and Dragons or something like that?
Yeah. Or? I never could get into Dungeons and Dragons, but I wish I had.
It's never too late. Maybe I already know the answer to this question, but I'm thinking really kind of pre-high school-ish time. Mm-hmm. Did you have any concept whatsoever of what you wanted to do when you grew up?
I did. So I wanted to be a pilot, right? Or an astronaut or something like that. That was my young dream. And I think I carried that till high school when I learned that if you're colorblind, you can't be either of those things, right? So that was dashed. And so I really just kind of like, well, I guess I'll go be an engineer.
Right.
But I couldn't get into aerospace engineering at Georgia Tech. I wasn't that smart. But I eventually made my way through there.
Interesting. So, and that's something I don't think I ever knew about you before, which is you're colorblind?
Yes.
Interesting.
It drives staff crazy. They'll create a map with a satellite image of and then they'll put a red box on it. And I'm like, where's the box?
Well, I mean, I guess that's a good segue to your time as a grocery magnate, or at least you worked in grocery stores. That must have been frustrating, the difference between a Macintosh apple and a Red Delicious apple.
Oh, no, I was an expert.
Well, let's talk about that. When did you start? Was it as soon as you were old enough to start working?
14. I started bagging groceries at the A&P in Atlanta. And basically, I did that through high school, then I went to college. And then, at some point, I basically realized that I needed to work while I was in college. So I worked full-time and went to Georgia Tech. in grocery and made my way all the way up to the front end manager, like managing all the cashiers and everything. Fortunately, they tried to recruit me to run a whole store, but I knew better.
No, yeah, I was going to ask
I've
you.
I've seen them. I've seen that job. Yeah.
I mean, I guess it's not public, so it's like, I don't know where A&P rates on the scale of between
Kroger and
public. I don't know
if they exist anymore.
No.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Did you ever consider, it sounds like you considered it well and then said, no, thank you. But had you ever considered, like, 7 years is a long time to do something.
Oh, yeah. No, it was, it was a great experience when you talk about managing in that environment, right? So it was really good, but I knew I wanted to become more of a professional angle and get into the environment, honestly.
So you finish high school and you end up at Georgia Tech. You're studying engineering, as one does when they go to Georgia Tech.
Right.
Was it because your dad went there?
That was part of it. I applied to other places. It really wasn't. I was going to Georgia Tech. It wasn't like that, but it was in state. You know, it was a good deal, and if I could get in, then that's a good degree. And so, right. And then you would, at that point in my life, I was just looking at, well, how much will I make when I get my degree, right? And so Georgia Tech was a good spot for, you know, making sure you had a good living when you're done with college.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, let's talk about that kind of move from in college to even beyond. Where in that timeline, a lot of people have this kind of, some of it's awakening and some of them, it always was that way, where they were interested in environmental things or water things or biology things. Was there that moment for you in college, or did it come?
It was in college. So I was, when I first started college, I was really more into design and art and that kind of thing. But then I took a public speaking class like you have to do in college, and you have to choose subjects to do your public speaking on. And in that time, in the late 80s, the environmental movement was really picking up. Mm-hmm. So I just, every single talk that I did in public speaking was on an environmental issue, like the rainforest, whatever it was. And I just got into it, right? And I could really make a compelling case. And it really kind of sparked an incredible interest on my part, you know? And so I really... That's where it started, was just a public speaking class, you know?
Yeah, I want to work on that timeline a little bit, you know, in that regard, because did you start working at the EPA, and it's Region 4, which is also Atlanta, while you were in undergrad, or is it right after that?
No, it was right when I graduated.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so was that, for you, is that's where you wanted to end up, was at the EPA?
So I wanted to end up in a good job, essentially. And if I could get into the environmental field, that would be a bonus. So at this point, I met my lovely wife, Lissy, who was working at EPA. She had graduated Georgia Tech. I didn't meet her at college. We were neighbors. She was at EPA. As we were dating, I graduated. And so she said, well, let me pass your resume around at EPA. And so she passed my resume around. I got hired. She had a car. So I married her. I mean, it was right, perfect.
Right. Tell me about the work itself.
At EPA?
Yeah. That initial job, because you've done several there.
I started in the drinking water supply program, right? Mm-hmm. You know, public water supply. And that was right after the 1986 amendments to the Safe Drinking Water Act. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of rules coming out of EPA for drinking water. And so I was part of the team as a Southeast District to help states adopt those rules, review them, whether we could approve those rules as a federal agency, and then basically audit their implementation of them to make sure it was getting done right. So it was very much an oversight role, but, you know, hands-on in the aspect that your hands are on the state personnel, you know, and how they do their business, right, but not directly with the environment. But it was an incredible learning experience.
Right? It seemed like a lot of responsibility and scope for somebody that's, you know, what, 22, 23 years old, right?
Well, so I had supervisors. Yeah, there was a team of us. So it was a good group of folks. GS-5 came in and worked my way up to GS-13, 15. You know, at EPA, I basically went from drinking water over to underground injection and then over to surface water and the total maximum daily load program, right? So I kind of did a little bit of NPDES permitting. So I got a lot of experience in there. When I got into the surface water program, there was so much litigation going on in Florida, right?
What year was that then?
It was probably 2003.
Okay.
You know, 2002, 2003, when I got into the surface water side. And I was a branch chief. I was at that point. And this just the amount of litigation in Florida was astounding. And so I had to work through a lot of issues in Florida. I mean, when you're in the EPA in that region, you spend 90% of your time on Florida and the other 10% on the rest of the seven states.
Wow.
Right. So,
was it, for folks that don't know, including myself, the professional progression EPA, was it something that you wanted surface water in the end, or is it, was it them saying, now it's time for you to do this other thing? This is the slot for 13, 14, 15.
Right.
So that's what you're going to, that's what that means, is doing this.
You will notice, Brett, that as I progress in my career, I jump into bigger fires every time, right?
Yeah, we're going to cover that.
And so, you know, as I was sitting up there at EPA and a lot of attention was being paid on surface water, and I was working in other programs that were critical, but they weren't as volatile. And so I basically got recruited to go over and work in those volatile programs to try to help manage the problems in those programs.
Let's take a minute to talk about my friends at Resource Environmental Solutions. Our state presents unique challenges with its diverse ecosystems, landscapes, and the many demands on its natural resources. That's why RES uses an innovative approach and creative solutions to help municipalities, agencies, and local water resource groups navigate the ever-changing landscape of environmental regulations in Florida and throughout the country. RES actively restores habitats, hydrological regimes, and ecosystem functions across Florida, from the Panhandle to the Heartland, to the Florida Keys and everywhere in between. They focus on restoring floodplains and wetlands and improving water quality, which benefits a wide array of species that call Florida home. With an unwavering commitment to Florida's unique ecological communities, RES upholds long-term stewardship practices, guaranteeing sustainable outcomes that endure. Discover more about their work and commitment to Florida's communities and the environmental challenges they face by visiting www.res.us. All right, now back to the conversation. Sorry. So you've got your degree from Tech. You've got a great job. You're doing well. Somewhere in there, you decide that you need an MBA from Georgia State. Why? Why did you do that?
I was at EPA and you know, I was still young before kids. It's like I was always going to get an MBA to couple with my engineering degree just for career opportunities, right? And so I just did it at night school. Imagine riding MARTA at 10:30 at night in Atlanta. It was a good, and I'm telling you, after engineering at Georgia Tech, the next degree is pretty easy. So I was able to get that. And then I looked around to see if I was in finance, mm-hmm. right? So I was looking around to see if there was something I could do that was more lucrative. But man, it's like, no, there's nothing better out here than staying at EPA. And it really kind of reminded me of the value of public service. When you're in public service, you just feel good about it, right?
Right.
There is some value in that. And so I ended up staying at EPA. And that was I went and got an MBA and looked for jobs just to realize that I didn't need an MBA and to look for jobs.
Yeah, I was going to ask. Like, it sounds like that's intent. Like somebody's like wants to, you know, end up running their own firm or something like mm-hmm. that. That's interesting. It's like, let me ask you then about that. Does that service kind of run, do you think, in your DNA? I mean, you described your father. It sounds like a really cool dude.
Probably. So there's a lot. I mean, my mother, you could argue that helping folks out with their issues is a public service as well. Along the way, so they got divorced and remarried two other parents into my life, which I love to death, right? And I got four sisters along the way, too. Mm. So we're all still very tight, right? And there was a teacher and someone else who worked in public schools on that side. So there's a lot of service orientation in my family.
Mm. Yeah. Let's move from Georgia to Florida. So you do your childhood education, 16-year career, right, at EPA, working for the federal government, all in Georgia, all in Atlanta. But you leave for Florida in 2007. How and why?
Why did that happen?
Yeah, why?
But believe me, when I got here, there were people that came into my office like, you had a sweet gig up there. What are you doing here? It was opportunity, Brett. I mean, if any other state had called, I'd have been like, no, I'm good. But Florida was where the action was. And I have perspectives. I've seen it in other places. But in Florida, the public is like tenfold, maybe 50-fold more interested in the environment. And that translates to programs and translates to opportunities to actually make a difference. And I could help. I could see that I could help. I don't know if Jerry Brooks was the division director. They were forming the new division. He needed a deputy, so he called me up. I was in Florida when he called me up, so he caught me perfectly because I was sitting, like, staring at the beach in Caribou, Florida, and talked to the wife, and she's like, let's do it. Let's go to Tallahassee. Let's see what happens. It was a really good move.
Well, I'm glad you did, and I know a lot of people are. Was Florida a place, the Gulf Coast, a place that you went a lot? And it happens a lot. We see a lot of folks, especially around here at the beach, they're almost all from Georgia, Florida, Tennessee, or Georgia, Alabama, Tennessee, rather. Also from Florida once in a while. Had you been coming to Florida before?
Yeah, Caribou, my mom had a house in Caribou, and it was on the coast. And so it was a frequent. The family would go down there all the time, get on the bay, do things like that. That was a vacation spot, right? Mm-hmm. It was just where you'd go and enjoy it. It really didn't have much to do with it was more like we could make a difference.
Right. You know? Well, and that's the thing, is like, because you chose, and it's what I consider probably the third most difficult job at an agency of a couple thousand people, is the director of DEER. It's mostly because you never do it right. You know, you're doing it right, but no one else thinks you're doing it right on either.
It's a heavy boulder to push up a hill.
Yeah, talk about what DEER is and then what it does, because some people may not know that I would say half of all the most consequential environmental programs are supervised and run out of it.
Yeah. So when I got there, it was a new division. So they had just formed it, and it was fledgling. The law had just passed to establish basin management action plans. Mm. And so basically DEER is the one that says, this water body is impaired. We've got the data and the science to show it for pollution reasons. So, and then that division says, here's the goal, here's what we have to get to, and they establish that in rules. And then they set up the plan on how to get there, right? And when you look across the state, there's a lot of challenges, from springs to major rivers like the St. John's River to major lakes like Lake Okeechobee. There are some challenges on restoring our water bodies. And so it all kind of emanates out of DEER, Division of Environmental Assessment and Restoration. And so, but it was, the rules were getting crafted. So you have the opportunity to say, there's a better way to do it. Why don't we try this? Why don't we work with the communities to try this? And there was a lot of engagement to try to get it done as best we could.
What was your philosophy in getting to a point where, man, not everyone's happy, some people are really unhappy, but how did you help mitigate against the worst of that, where people thought maybe you were skimping on the protection or you're doing too much?
It gets down to, you have to be able to communicate with everybody. You're only going to be able to implement what society as a whole can live with. The good part about Florida, which is why I'm here, is that society wants it to be different. No matter who you talk to, they don't want the impaired water. They want it to be better. They want to come up with solutions. And so everybody, this is why I tell people, we all have the same goal. We all want to get there. The how is the hard part. Mm-hmm. And so that's the thing that people get their opinions on and how to do it. And you got to keep that engagement going. You can't get to a point. If you get to litigation, that's unfortunate, because then you haven't navigated it as well as it could have been navigated. So it is one of those things that, and it's, I'm telling you, it's different whether you're in Volusia County versus Hillsborough County versus, they're all different. And so you have to adapt. Yeah, you have to adapt to those specific locations and what's going on.
Yeah, because you see in a lot of the BMAPs or the TMDLs, the nutrient concentration, many of them look exactly the same in terms of, like, the 0.35 milligrams per liter, 0.22 or something like that. But it seems like you do have to take an individual approach to each one, because every community is different, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Each problem can be unique as well, like the pollution source. You may have a different solution in one place versus another, where you're doing septic to sewer versus agricultural practices, right? So it's, each solution set's going to be different, and you have to engage that community in the community to try to get that solution going and make progress.
Yeah, it makes for a lot of tough meetings. I've been in a bunch of those, myself, and I think your folks did their best, acquitted themselves well, I think, in that process. It's a hard job to do. And being the face of a program like that has got to be tough. A
lot of time on the road.
But it seems like other folks liked how you did that as well, because they rewarded that competence with the next role, which is the Deputy Secretary of Ecosystems Restoration, and which has all the things that you just described, plus some more stuff. And look, I was like, you can be forgiven for not knowing how crazy it could get in Deer when you're working on these B maps, but you chose the Deputy Secretary job with your eyes open. Talk about that, move into that, and why you want it. Was it just the natural next step to trying to serve in that role?
Yeah, it was. And then you have more tools, right, to make a difference, mm-hmm. right? So in Deer, you know, you can get a lot done in division in Deer. And honestly, I remember the conversation it was with Herschel Vineyard and Jeff Littlejohn about taking the deputy secretary job. And I said, I'll take it if I can bring Deer with me, mm-hmm. right? Because it didn't, in this organizational structure, it was mostly Everglades at the time. And so because I wanted to have that tool set, that was great. Then I got to be exposed to Everglades restoration and what that entails. When John Steverson came on, he was looking for a way to really move the funds, right? To put the funds to work in a really quick way. So we worked together to form a new division, which is where all the restoration money went through, right? Mm-hmm. SRF, you know, Springs, lots of good funds went through. And I pulled Trina Vielhauer over with me, who was my deputy at Deer. That division has been able to really set up an incredible process to make a difference mm-hmm. in putting money to work. So there you had, if you're going to try to do something with ecosystem restoration, to have all the tools there to try to shepherd it.
Yeah, it was something I remember at the time. Is like dealing with you, and especially with Trina and Julie Espy, was, are we making the connection? It sounds like there was this big disconnect between here's the water quality problem and here's a regulatory aspect of it. And we have this thing over here where ostensibly the solutions take place. Like, and why those two things aren't joined and why they're not talking to each other every day seemed weird. And so it seemed like a lot of effort was being put into making that connection. How much of that is due to you, and how much of that is due to just a natural evolution of something like this? Doesn't everyone knows this doesn't work, we got to do it better?
It's problem solving. You see a problem out there, and when you're sitting in that job, you can see the problems pretty quick, or if you don't, people will tell you.
Right.
So we were adapting. We were trying to make it better. There was a high demand to make progress, right? A huge demand to make progress on environmental restoration. And so we were adapting, trying to find better ways, find better solutions. There's a number of things we were adapting to try to do that. And I mean, part of it is I could send my staff out to put a BMAP together, but I could also empower the local government to put a BMAP together, mm-hmm. right? And so there's a big push to, hey, if you want to come up with your own restoration plan, I'm all for it. You know, let's do it. And so we were trying to push some of those as well. And you know, septic to sewer is a huge challenge. You know, dealing with septic tanks, it's not always to sewer, but just dealing with septic tank pollution in our springs was something that I really had to jump into with both feet. And so we, and I know, Brett, you were a part of this. We worked with communities to set up that 10-year plan and set up a process where the state funding would be there when they got to phase two and phase three. So there wasn't any hiccups, and they could work with the community to come up with a plan and communicate it, because those are tough things to do.
Yeah.
So we were trying to work on with locally here in Tallahassee, Leon County and Wakulla, to try to put that plan together. And it was, you know, those are the big lifts, and you couldn't really do that if you didn't have the funding and the Deer all kind of working together.
Yeah, right, no doubt. And I think that was, for something that seems not that huge of a deal, I think it is really that difference makers when you go into someone and you're trying to deal with how do you correct ecological impairment, and you say, well, here's the thing you got to fix. It's like, but we may or may not help you this year or next year.
Right.
But you're still but you still have to do it. And so when you join those two things together to be able to map that over years, and the predictability is the big part, is do we really have a partner in Leon County or Wakulla County? And the answer is yes, if we all know that we're going to be partners 8 years from now.
Right.
And I think that really moved things forward. And I hope that we do a lot more of that type of thing in other aspects as well.
Well, when the legislature makes the funds recurring.
Right.
Right. That's a game changer. Right.
Yeah.
Because then you can start that contract and know it's going to be there the next year. Right.
Yeah. Let's move into that transition to your new role, but I want to hit back on something that you just mentioned. You got exposed to the Everglades. Was it not something you dealt much with or knew much about
before? Not as deeply. When I was at EPA, we were part of the Everglades, and I was part of that discussion. And then, you know, in Deer, when Jerry was there, it was in within Deer, and so it was tangential, but not as like responsible until I was deputy secretary, and then it was.
Sometimes to my chagrin, and sometimes not. Obviously, it's an important place ecologically for Florida for its own sake, but it seems to take up a lot of headspace, disproportionately or not, doesn't matter. How much of your headspace did something like that take up?
I mean, it wasn't overwhelming. Like, you wouldn't do the 90% kind of rule. It was because Springs was a big deal when I was there as well.
Yeah.
And so I would say it was, I mean, it was a good 30%, 40%, you know, something like that. Mm. And it all depended on the, you know, what was happening. Like, if there was discharges, if there was algae, it was 90%. But that wasn't always like that, right? You have dry seasons. So it was... Yeah, it was big when it was big, but then I really made time to deal with Indian River Lagoon. Like, I sat on the Indian River Lagoon Council, you know, I made time for Springs because there was a lot of work to do. I just made sure that I spread my time through for all of it.
Yeah.
Right.
I think it's just, you know, part of being, you know, a good manager anyway, is to, you know, you got to make room for all of it and leave it to, you know, the folks that work for you who are more than competent to handle all of that. Notwithstanding a restoration program that I don't think I've met anyone who's like, the Everglades is terrible, we should not do things to restore it. But every other aspect of the job down there at South Florida Water Management District seems like a waking nightmare to me. And it's just, it's more things, more administration, more regulatory items, more existential problems that you're facing down there. Why did you want to go down there? And we'll talk about some of those challenges.
I mean, it's kind of just in my DNA to run where the opportunities exist. And there is a lot of momentum going on with what can you accomplish, right? When you look at the South Florida Water Management District and look at the tools they have and the kind of support they have to try to actually do something that makes a difference for people in the environment, it's there, right? Mm-hmm. It's ready. It's right. Ready for the taking. And so I felt like I could take my skill set down there to try to make progress, try to eliminate as much conflict as possible, because that's what I've been doing my whole career.
Right.
And get the district to a point where we're just seeing the stuff get into the ground. We're seeing it happen. There's less litigation, all that kind of stuff. Mm. And try to, at the end of my career, be able to point to something and say, okay, that looks better than it did.
Yeah, I guess I want to kind of poke at that a little bit, because at the time, it's like, I can't imagine anyone who'd have been better suited to do it. And I still believe that. But at the time, it was like, well, this seems fairly obvious. Did you feel like at the time that it was obvious? Did you have moments of doubt? Like, am I finally biting off more than I can chew?
Honestly, Brett, no. You know, my family criticizes me for having too high a self-esteem. It's like, could you tone it down a notch? I have certainly had failures in my life, but I'll do what I can. I want to help as best I can. And this is a good opportunity to try to make a difference.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not like, you know, no one else in the history of the South Florida Water Management District has made a difference. It's like, but
right, yeah.
But you're dealing with a huge number of challenges. And as I said, like, some of them existential sounds like, you know, what is it, day after, what, you know, like a nuclear bomb's going off or a giant tsunami. Not exactly. It's like, but you're dealing with some really big things. Talk about some of the ones that maybe people don't think as much about, like the CSNF, the works of the district, all of all the ways that you have to move water and how much harder that is getting as the years go on.
We had to start from the beginning. Like, when the district was formed, it was to operate a flood control system, right? So the state was reclaiming the Everglades in partnership with the federal government to make it viable for agriculture and cities and just communities to form and not get flooded, and because there were some pretty devastating floods. And so we were formed to operate that flood control system, which is more than 2,000 miles of canals, and then we got 900 pumps, you know, structures and 90 pump stations. It's just a massive flood control system. So that was formed, and it was formed and built in the 50s and 60s, right? And it does a phenomenal job. The rain we had in Irma was the same rain that caused all those floods back in the 20s and 40s, and we didn't have that occur. So it does a phenomenal job. You know, fast forward 30 years after it was built or 40, and you see, okay, now we're having different impacts to this. You know, we're losing water out to our estuaries that we could use for good beneficial uses like environment or people, right?
Right.
And by the way, dropping all that water on our estuaries is not good for them, right? Mm-hmm. You don't want to take your estuary and make it into a lake. So it has been an evolution of adaptation to this flood control system to make it more suitable for South Florida and viable and, by the way, have water supply for everybody as well, right? Not impacted like it had been doing. So that's where Comprehensive Everglades comes in. So that's underway, right? And so we're going to build reservoirs. We're going to keep the water in the state. We're going to use it for the benefits of our environment and societies. And that's going along very well.
All right, let's take a minute to talk about my friends at Sea and Shoreline. When I say the names Andrew, Ian, Irma, and Michael, what immediately enters your mind? If you answered hurricanes, congratulations, you're a Floridian. We all know that hurricanes bring devastating wind, rain, and storm surge. What you may not already know is that my friends at Sea and Shoreline are the leading innovators in the quest to mitigate the destructive wave energy of storm surges with their patented wave attenuation devices, or WADs. Not only can WADs protect against the effects of storm surge, they can also protect our beaches and shorelines from the massive erosion events that tropical storms and hurricanes bring. In fact, WADs have been shown to increase shoreline accretion. That's right. Their technology can help build shorelines. Sea and Shoreline is committed to protecting and preserving Florida's communities and coastlines because they are Floridians, and these are their communities too. To find out how you can partner with Sea and Shoreline to protect your community, visit them at www.seaandshoreline.com. You'll be glad you did. All right, let's get back to the conversation. Drill down for a second. I don't mean to interrupt but just for that part, before we kind of expand it beyond there, talk about the movement, and the things I'm interested in are things that end up impacting on the coast and these estuaries. You look at the Indian River Lagoon, Biscayne Bay, Caloosahatchee's. Like, so talk a little bit about, because you have some successes that are at least there or then in the works when you look at water headed to St. Lucie and water headed to Caloosahatchee side.
So basically the whole footprint, the whole idea, like I said, is keeping water in the system. Mm-hmm. So we have finished one reservoir, right? We being us and the Corps of Engineers. And that is between Lake Okeechobee and the St. Lucie Estuary. That is online now. It's going through operational testings. They're making little repairs here and there. We are able to turn those massive pumps on. And when it's raining in that basin and that water wants to go and hit the estuary in a harmful way, turn the pumps on, it doesn't, right? It stays in the system. It goes to this reservoir. We can move it to a wetland treatment system to treat it before it gets back to the environment. So these types of projects, now they're not cheap, hundreds of millions of dollars, right? Sometimes more than a billion.
How much for that one?
That one was about, I think it was about $600 million. And so when you have that happen, it gives the estuary a chance to recover. There's more to be built, but they absolutely make a difference. It captured, like Ian, when it dropped all the rain, that's Hurricane Ian, discharged to the estuary for weeks and weeks and weeks, and it was probably 1 week.
Wow.
Because we had those pumps. So,
how much of a difference does it make? I certainly understand the desire, because deal with the same sort of issues all around the state. But when you look at not just the amount of fresh water turning it into, you know, a lake, as you said, does that also include the water quality improvement aspect of it, which is, you know, typically you'd have more nutrient-laden water, right? Does it? How much of that does it help mitigate against?
Oh, it's huge. If you can turn off the flow and capture it and put it through a wetland treatment system, then it's not hitting the estuary in a harmful way, both from a water quality. I mean, it's kind of dirty water too, so it'll drop all its sediment in the estuary and some other resources. So it just doesn't have to be that way. It's a canal hitting it. And this happens in Biscayne Bay. It happens in a lot of things. So the whole project is about $26 billion, right, all across South Florida.
Right.
And people will say Everglades restoration. And so if you talk to the common person about Everglades restoration, they're thinking the swamp.
Right.
But it's so much more than that. It's Lake Okeechobee. It's the estuaries all around down there. It's a 55,000-acre wetland restoration system in Collier County, which is panther habitat. So it's so much more than just Everglades restoration.
Sure.
So.
Let's move from that and talk about something that's a term that's become hotter and hotter for people to mention. I think a lot of people may not know precisely what it means, but people say resiliency or resilience a lot in Florida. In Southeast Florida is kind of the most immediate business end, the impacts of some things that are happening. I mean, storms affect us all, obviously. But when you look at things like sea level rise, king tides that are becoming more and more intrusive, you have, as you mentioned, your water movement system, flood control system.
Right.
How do those things interact, and how do you see the next steps forward in dealing with that?
So it's an epicenter of a problem. So our flood control system is basically a series of canals that go through Miami-Dade, Broward, Palm Beach County, all the way up to Indian River County, quite frankly. And those canals go from the Everglades all the way to the coast, mm-hmm. and all the communities in between those canals. And what they're designed to do is collect all the water from the rain and move it out to tide, right? And move it out to the sea to protect the communities from flooding. The challenge is the sea is getting higher, and these structures at the coast are gravity, right? So basically, you have a king tide or a tide, and the water on the downstream side of that structure is higher than the upstream. If you open the structure, it goes the wrong way,
right?
So you're not doing flood control. This past November, we had a big storm go through Miami-Dade County. I couldn't open a lot of gates at high tide. I had to wait for low tide to open gates. And so the solution is basically become more like the Dutch, and where they have pumps at the end of their canal systems. So we have a whole program in our resiliency program doing the modeling and everything to figure out how to retrofit that whole flood control system down there to deal with the sea level rise that we're seeing in the king tides. I mean, we've got videos of the water special conditions, king tide with onshore wind, where it just basically flows over the top of the structure, right?
Right.
The ocean, right? So that's unusual. But most of the time, you can see it. You can see it in our data sets, because we have downstream, upstream readings that show that at high tide, you just can't open the structure, right? Mm. That's a problem.
Yeah.
Right? And so if you're trying to take care of communities and everything, there's something to do here. And so we've retrofitted two structures in about 10, 15 years ago with pumps, but there's a lot more.
Yeah. Two of how many?
Right. There's like 22, 23.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you treat it?
It doesn't all have to happen at once, right?
I was going to say.
It's most risky in Miami-Dade, and then it gets, over time, the risk gets to Miami-Dade level in Broward and Palm Beach and going north. So I
assume then it's part of a capital improvement plan or work plan where you're looking at, hey, we do this and this and this as money allows, and it's almost always a question of money.
And we've been successful in getting FEMA grants for three structures, mm-hmm. and the Corps is starting to pick up the ball and as far as doing another planning study to reevaluate the CNSF system.
Talk about how you see the district's role, and I think a lot of the others, and I think yourself, is you're going to have the same answer, is looking more and more at the water quality items that maybe used to simply belong, or at least thought was more belong to DEP. And I'm thinking of septic tanks, I think most specifically, and you've got tons of them. I mean, Miami-Dade County has some 200,000 septic tanks. How much time do you spend thinking about that and working toward that with communities, with DEP, in terms of that remediation?
So this is one of those circumstances where basically Miami-Dade County picked up their restoration plan in lieu of DEP and tried to do that in lieu. And so I kind of leave it to Miami-Dade and DEP to take care of septic tanks. And it's one of the things I'll tell people about the benefits of moving to my new job is I can think less about septics.
Yeah, I didn't mean to pile on to you or just like, hey, can I create another giant multi-billion-dollar headache for yourself or challenge for yourself? But at least I want
it's a problem that needs to be solved, because you can see the data inside our canals where you have that influence.
Yeah. So I think at around, I guess, think of like 11 or 12 years of me working in state government, it became the conclusion to me was going to be, I'm going to do this for 30 odd years, or at least until they kick me out. Does that ever occur to you in your mind at this point? You spent a lot of years in government. Are you a, do you consider yourself a lifer, or do you think about a life outside of what you do now, the public service?
No, I'll be public servant the rest of my life. It's I want to be on the stage. I don't know. It's an illness. But yeah, it's just where I feel I can do the best. Right. So
yeah,
it's one of those things that's, I will always be a public servant. Yeah.
Wonderful. So how can people get in touch with you, get in touch with the district, find out more about these types of programs, CERB, you know, and the rest of it?
Basically, we do have a good website. Look at sfwmd.gov. And if you can't find it easily there, there's a place where you can just type a question in and we can get right back to you. Yeah. Right. So it's, I mean, shoot, just Google Everglades Restoration. You'll find plenty of resources.
Yeah. It's out there. I'll put them. I always ask the question of folks, especially ones that are working in government, because I want, you know, people to connect with you and the good work you're doing, but I always put it on the episode notes anyway. So look for them there, folks, when it's just below where you push the start button. All right. So given the different roles that you've had, and you can include EPA as well, was there anything in one of those where you feel like you left something undone, or you may have done differently given your experience now?
That's kind of like a growing pains question. Yeah. Leaving things undone, just taking a new job, you leave things undone, yeah, right? And so there is a lot of work to be done. I mean, you're not done. Let's just put it this way. You're not done until the water body's restored, right? As you're sitting in those rules and you're thinking about how hard you're working on restoring your water bodies, and then you see the public complaints about the water bodies, get real. Those complaints are going to be there until it's fixed,
yeah,
right? So you just got to keep working on it. And you do have successes, Brad. I mean, look at the St. John's River, look at Wakulla Springs, Lake Apopka. There's successes are out there, so we know it can be done. Heck, the Keys got retrofitted. They finished their septic disorder program, right? So it can be done. It's just that perseverance. One of the things that was like the worst experience in my life, trying to navigate and set human health criteria according to EPA rules. And when you're trying to take that carcinogenic science and talk to the public about it, it is a very challenging thing. I do not regret that we weren't successful, because we weren't successful, but I think that was the right move, right? You know, let's just let EPA do it. It was very painful, right? And it was an ERC meeting that I will never forget, but I wish I could.
I remember those days, and it was, I think, brave may be a slight overstatement. It's like, but for someone in government where failure or doing some things that are difficult or controversial are often rewarded with an exit rather than the ability to move forward with it, good, bad, or otherwise, I thought it was significant. I thought it was well laid out. And it wasn't just, despite the communication of it, it wasn't just the public at large, like the folks that, you know, it's hard to explain the dosage levels of something, or that some of those things don't even exist anymore in the United States in terms of use. I was around academics who, you know, where someone would explain, I'm not going to give names, but where someone else who does understand this is explaining to other people with PhDs line by line, no, this all seems okay to me.
I mean, right.
You know, EPA can, I mean, we expect them, right, to be able to know how to do this.
Right.
And if not, then that's a whole other can of worms,
right,
you know, on its own. And so, yeah, I thought it was the right thing to do, the natural thing to do. When we say we're follow the science or we're about the science,
right,
it's got to mean that or it doesn't mean that, right?
Yeah, it's the way it is. I mean, but it's also understandable if you're someone and you're looking at an agency and they're lowering the benzene criteria,
yeah,
based on science, but we don't want any benzene, right? I mean, you know, it's just, right, it's a natural reaction. I don't blame anybody for being upset about it.
Are you optimistic about the future of the environment and natural systems in Florida?
Yeah, you know I am. And really it is, I mean, just think about this session, right? Think that there's so many Floridians that care about the environment. And that is reflected in our leaders. And so you think about, we have this new revenue source coming in with the compact, right? And that could go to anything, go to housing, roads, potholes, whatever. It could go to anything. And they're setting it up for it all to go to the environment. And where else would that happen, right? It happens in Florida. We're seeing record funding for South Florida. We're seeing just the amount of effort to fix our systems is phenomenal. And so it's really up to our agencies and the people in our agencies to make that work. Mm-hmm. So, okay, they're saying, here's your resources, go make it work. And so it's a challenge for us as public servants, but you know, we're happy to take it on and we're happy to have the opportunity to do that thing and look at the results. And in South Florida, we're seeing estuaries come back to life. You know, we're seeing the Everglades and the bird populations come back to life because these investments are finally taking shape. Yeah, because I've always known that the solution is infrastructure, whether it's municipal infrastructure, flood control infrastructure, agricultural infrastructure, it's always in that, right? And you're not going to get those solutions without some sort of support from a funding standpoint. So the support is there and we just got to seize it. And shoot, we're seeing the difference.
Yeah.
Right. No doubt. And so, and the public is there with us. Everyone's there with us to try to make a difference here. So yeah, I'm definitely optimistic.
What worries you the most at this point? Is there something where, you know, like a good engineer, you say infrastructure for, you know, for everything, where is the thing that you don't see quite the light at the end of the tunnel yet on?
You know, I don't know that I can pinpoint anything. You know, it's always a process, right? Ultimately, the funding isn't there without the relationships, right? So it's about maintaining and fostering relationships. And so when you see a relationship start to go sour, a constituency, whoever, right? Whoever the relationship is with, it's important to the result. It's a matter of getting in there and making sure you take care of it. And that takes a lot of energy. So it is that constant maintenance of the engagement to keep the relationships in a positive direction, right? Because at any moment they can go sour. One lawsuit and things go really sour, right? So it is, because then you stop communicating.
Yeah.
Right. So it's a matter of keeping the relationships there, keeping the conversations there, and trying to find those mutual places. But it's a constant thing.
I like it. What advice would you give to young people who are thinking about getting into water, the environmental field?
Right. So I do this thing where everybody that comes to work at the district, I'll give them a call and welcome them. Those are the best conversations. They're great conversations because then you can have that conversation with folks that are just, most of them coming straight out of college, right? Mm-hmm. And it's about keeping your eyes open for the opportunities, right? You're in a great field. You're going to love water. Anyone who goes into water doesn't leave water.
Yes.
And so you're going to love this job. And there's so much opportunity here. Keep your eyes open. Get smart at what you're doing now. Get good at what you're doing. But just within this agency, don't hesitate to get other experiences because there's plenty of them to have. You'll love it.
Well said. I think that's a good place for us to quit. Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks for listening to Water for Fighting. If you enjoyed the show, please be sure to subscribe on whatever platform you use. And don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review. I mean it. You can follow the show on LinkedIn and Instagram at FLWaterPod, and you can reach me directly at FLWaterPod@gmail.com with your comments and suggestions for who and or what you'd like to know more about. Production of this podcast is by Lonely Fox Studios. Thanks to Carl Soren for making the best of what he had to work with, and to Dave Barfield for the amazing graphics and technical assistance. A very special thank you goes out to Bo Spring from the Bo Spring Band for giving permission to use his music for the podcast. The song is called Doing Work for Free. You should check out the band live or wherever great music is sold. Join me next time for another amazing conversation with someone who has helped shape water and environmental policy in the Sunshine State. Until then, keep your whiskey close and water closer.